You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here this evening. Thank you to the sponsors. Thank you to the local politicians who are joining us this evening. Thank you to all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to talk community economics. I'm going to begin and end my talk tonight by talking about mothers. Now, it's not Mother's Day, but in my life, it is Mother's Day. Today is the day my mother turned 90. And there is a story, well, when I was introduced, two things were said about me. I was an economist and a lawyer. One thing that was not said, but is often said, is I live in Washington, D.C. And most places I go, those are three automatic strikes against you. So you hate my guts already before I've said anything. And I remember when I graduated from law school, I told my mom that I was not going to work for a law firm. I was going to have an unconventional career trying to promote peace and prosperity. And she looked at me incredibly cross, like only a Jewish mother can, and say, "Son, someday there's going to be peace on the planet and prosperity everywhere, and you'll be happy you have the law degree to fall back on." Well, sadly, we have not had an outbreak of peace and prosperity quite yet. But what we're going to talk about tonight is a lot of things that communities have done to move us closer in that direction. So I'm calling my talk tonight the Local Agenda for BC. And in the spirit of all things shifty, which you can see in the program, the subtitle has got to be Shift for Brains. Now, I want to begin by talking about how we approach the concept of prosperity. When you talk with economic developers around the world, and I think that probably the economic developers here in Vancouver are a somewhat different animal, but when you talk with economic developers, the phrase that one hears, often at a baud rate of once a minute, is our mission is to attract and retain business, attract and retain. What's odd about that formulation is that it has nothing to do with local business. You cannot attract a local business. That's an oxymoron. And if the only way you retain a local business is by paying it some kind of bribe, how local is that business? But what this tells us is that most of the profession, most of the practice of economic development these days has nothing to do with local business. It's all about supporting global business. And this is unfortunate because there is a massive and growing body of evidence that the most successful businesses in generating real economic development are local business. My three rules for local prosperity are therefore, number one, we should try to maximize local ownership of business in our community. Number two, we should maximize local self-reliance, not as a way of pulling back from the global economy, but actually as a way of engaging with the global economy from a position of strength. And finally, we need to spread models of triple bottom line success. So I'm going to describe a little bit what I mean by these concepts and what some of the evidence is for these rules. Then I'm going to talk about what we should be doing about this in terms of a sort of big 30,000 foot picture of local economic development. And I'm going to wrap up by talking about local investment, because I think capital is the one kind of shift that we desperately need to begin and hasn't been a big enough piece of these discussions. Rule number one, why we should maximize local ownership. Now, I can't steal the thunder of two brilliant economists who are going to be unveiling a study that they did for Vancouver tomorrow, Dan Houston and Matt Cunningham. But I will say that they shook things up in the economic development community in 2002 when they did a study in Austin, Texas, from which this graph is derived. This graph shows the impact of $100 spent at a Borders bookstore, Borders being global, non-local, now bankrupt, and comparing that with $100 spent at a local bookstore. And what they found was $100 spent at the Borders left $13 in the local economy. $100 spent at the local bookstore left $45. So roughly speaking, buy the same book at the same price at the local bookstore, and you get three times the jobs in your community, three times the income and the wealth effects, three times the tax collections, three times the charitable contributions. We're not talking about small degrees of difference. Why was there this difference? Well, the local bookstore naturally had a high-level management team on the ground. The Borders didn't. The local bookstore used local business services like lawyers and accountants. The Borders didn't. The local bookstore advertised on local radio and TV. The Borders didn't. The local bookstore had a stream of profits that came into the community. The Borders didn't. Just those four items can easily be 15, 20, 25% of the spending of a given business. And to generalize, if you have two businesses that are similar, one locally owned, one not locally owned, it would be very hard to imagine how the non-locally owned business would have a higher degree of spending and multiplier impact in your community. And in point of fact, these gentlemen have gone on to do nearly a dozen studies themselves, but we also have a dozen other studies around the country and around the world, and they basically all show the same thing, that local businesses are generating 2 to 4 times more multiplier spending in the local economy than our non-locally owned business. Now, don't take my word for this. Harvard Business Review in the summer of 2010 had this article that said more small firms means more jobs. And it's a regression analysis that was done by a couple of Harvard economists looking at 200 metro areas in the United States. And what they found was that per capita job growth was correlated with the presence of small and home-based businesses. And then another study that came out 6 months later from Penn State and published in a journal, the Economic Development Quarterly, which is often hostile to local economy ideas, that study showed that per capita income growth was also correlated with the presence not just of small businesses, but locally owned businesses. There is a vast literature now that shows that local businesses are key for creating walkable communities. You cannot have a walkable community in a big box hellhole. It just doesn't work spatially. Local businesses are key for tourism because people want to see what is unique about your city. Local businesses generate entrepreneurship, which means it's an investment in future economic growth. There is now an emerging public health literature that shows that the nurturing of local food and local food businesses is good for bringing down incidences of type 2 diabetes and obesity. There's a sociology literature that shows that local businesses are correlated with higher degrees of social order and lower crime. There is a political science literature that shows that local businesses tend to increase voting participation, and volunteership in nonprofits. This is a very, very long list of reasons why, all things being equal, we should be focusing economic development laser-like on local businesses. Rule number two, we need to maximize local self-reliance. Now, if you think about it, the most prosperous community is going to be one that sells as much as it can locally and as much as it can globally. Local, global, that's the whole thing. And you take one of those things away, and your community is missing something. Well, one of the classic mistakes of economic development is to assume that if you just focus on the global side of the picture, the local side takes care of itself. And in point of fact, what we know is the causality works in exactly the opposite direction. That if you nurture local businesses, many of them will naturally begin to look toward regional, national, and global markets, and they won't need subsidies or support in order to get there. Now, since this flies in the face of a lot of theories about why every city should become hyper-dependent and vulnerable to global trade, I want to give two examples of communities that became very wealthy through this quest for self-reliance. The first example comes from a headline in the International Herald Tribune a few years back. It says, "Dead-end Austrian town blossoms with green energy." It's the story of a 3,000-person town in Austria called Gusing. Gusing historically was an agriculture and forestry community. As the European community opened up to free trade, they started to fall apart. And they elected a mayor in the mid-90s who said the key to prosperity was that we should become self-reliant on something. They decided to focus on energy. So they took wood from the old forestry industry, and they created a district heating system involving some of the buildings in Gusing. In becoming more self-reliant on energy, they were importing a little bit less oil, coal, natural gas, and that made them a little bit wealthier. They took that wealth and they invested in another energy business, and then another, and another, and another. 15 years later, this 3,000-person community created 50 new energy businesses with 1,000 new jobs. And in doing so, brought down their carbon footprint by 95%. Now, this is a great model. And notice that they didn't isolate themselves. Many of their energy products they were selling elsewhere in Europe, but they were basing it all in local business. Here's another example, closer to my home. Zingerman's, the little delicatessen that could in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Zingerman's, in its first 10 years, was a very successful deli, and they had a dilemma about how they would grow. They were afraid they would lose key staff unless they would continue to grow. And the question was, do they become a chain like Schlotzsky's? They argued against doing that for two reasons. One is, they were afraid that they would lose quality control, and that was one of the things they were known for. As Paul Saginaw, one of the founders of Zingerman, said, "The last thing I want to do in my declining years is fly around the nation visiting second-rate versions of myself." The second reason had to do with relationships. One of the things that Zingerman's loved about what they did is kibitzing with the people in Ann Arbor and having those ties, and they didn't want to lose that. So they decided that rather than growing broad, they would grow deep. And they looked at things coming into the deli and said, we could build some businesses around that. For example, we serve bread. Why don't we create a bakehouse? We serve coffee. We could create a roasting company. We serve cheese and ice cream. Why don't we create a creamery? And then they looked at things coming out of the deli and said, there's potential for value-added products. So, for example, we have great food. We could create a sit-down restaurant called the Roadhouse. We have great cakes. We could create a mail-order cake service. We have great customer service. We could create a module called Zing Train, where we bring in other businesses and train them how to treat their customers properly. So in all, Zingerman's is now 9 independently owned businesses. The partners meet once a week. They co-license the brand, and they help one another achieve high standards and quality control. But it's all locally owned businesses. These 9 businesses are responsible for 525 jobs in Ann Arbor, and their annual sales are now somewhere north of $40 million a year. What I think is interesting about Zingerman's is that economic development would have pronounced it impossible. Why? Because economic developers traditionally say, focus on your clusters of strength. Ann Arbor didn't have a cluster of strength in food. They had Bupkis going around in food. But they created a cluster from scratch. And that's what local economy building is all about. It's creating clusters of power from scratch. Rule number 3, spreading triple bottom line businesses. I don't need to convince you folks here of that. You're doing it throughout Vancouver, throughout the province. But I know that throughout Canada, as in the United States, there's a lot of differences of opinion about what constitutes an appropriate level of labor protection and an appropriate level of an environmental protection. I mean, frankly, this is a lot of what politics is all about, is battling over these standards. But here's where I know there's absolute consensus. If I went to the most conservative outpost in British Columbia and I said to them, would you rather have full employment with low labor and environmental standards or full employment with high labor and environmental standards, which would you prefer? And the opinion would be unanimous. It's only because we believe that there's a trade-off between prosperity and the standards that we have this argument. And to me, the best way of disproving this is to show businesses that are fabulously successful and have these high labor and environmental standards. I thought it was really nice that the mayor laid out how Vancouver, generally through public unions, has been able to maintain high quality and high labor and environmental standards in the city. Now, the only argument that I encounter about why we should not go local is competitiveness. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but let me just say this. If it were true that in this era of globalization, local businesses were becoming less competitive, we should be seeing jobs moving from small businesses into large global businesses. And in point of fact, the chart in front of you is the record in the United States between 1990 and 2010. And if the red blob in the top is the fraction of jobs in the economy in large business, what we define as having over 500 employees. The green blob at the bottom is small businesses with under 100 employees, and then the middle blob is mid-scale business. If you pull out a magnifying glass on that red blob, what you find is that, yes, there has been a slight shift of employment into larger businesses. It's about 2%. So you'd say, well, that's a little bit of a trend, but 2%, that's nothing. 2% in an era where public policy was tilted like a double diamond ski slope against local small business, because all of economic development in the United States was supporting the attraction and retention of global business through subsidies. In other words, they were subsidizing the defeat of local small business. Imagine if we had gotten public policy half right, what this curve might have looked like. There never would have been that 2% growth in the large business sector. And here's another point. This graph is jobs. It doesn't include home-based businesses and self-employed individuals. By some estimates, that constitutes about 20% of the U.S. economy right now, and it has grown spectacularly in the last 10 years. If you include home-based businesses and self-employment, these curves go in the opposite direction and shows the growing competitiveness of local and small business. Here's the record in Canada. Between 2000 and 2008, that was the last year I was able to get data for. And it shows that with one exceptional year, smaller businesses have been gradually capturing a higher percentage of jobs in the economy. So they are, in fact, becoming more competitive, more dominant in your society. What about profitability? If you pull out the appropriate page in Statistical Abstract in the U.S., what you find is that sole proprietorships, which most small businesses either are or start out as, are three times as profitable as C corporations, which most global companies are, with partnerships falling somewhere in between. And if you think that local businesses have shown remarkable competitiveness thus far, in a way you've seen nothing yet. Two-thirds of what we buy is services. Services are inherently local, and what we buy in services is expanding. So that part of the economy is going to move increasingly toward local business. What about goods? It's true that in both your country and mine, we import an awful lot of stuff from abroad. We, you know, in the United States, we have a terrible trade deficit with China. But it turns out that three-quarters of what we spend our money on in goods falls in a category called non-durable goods. Non-durable goods are things we consume regularly, like food, building materials, paper products. The characteristic of most non-durable goods is that they weigh a lot and have a relatively low dollar value per weight, per unit weight. So what this means is that when we start to have $200 a barrel oil or $500 a barrel oil, which most of us understand is sooner or later likely to happen, the first sectors that we're going to localize are non-durable goods like food. This is the underlying reason why we're starting to see this movement toward local food besides the taste and aesthetics of it. This leads me then to what my agenda is for local economic development, how one undertakes a 10% shift. In my view, there are six key P's that we need to focus on: planning, people, partners, purse, purchasing, and policymaking. By planning, I mean let's identify leaks in our economy, all the places where we are unnecessarily consuming outside goods and services, because those leaks represent market opportunities for newer expanded local businesses. People, how do we generate a new generation of local entrepreneurs? Partners, how do we create networks of local businesses that are more competitive as a group than those businesses would be individually? Purse, how do we tap into savings, both short-term savings in banks and credit unions and long-term savings in pension funds, and put those savings to work in local business? Purchasing, how do we spearhead 10% shift and local first campaigns? And policymaking, how do we remove anti-local biases? I want to give you one or two examples of each of these things so that you have a sense of what they mean. So let's first talk about planning. What does local planning really look like? It means systematically identifying all the leaks in your economy. And as was mentioned in my introduction, a lot of what I do in the United States contractually is I work with cities, regions, to calculate what is the level of leakage in all of the sectors of their economy, or sometimes I focus on food. So an example of one of these studies is 2010, the 25% shift, which was looking at what would happen in Metro Cleveland if we were able to move residents in that region to purchase 25% more of their food locally. And the answer was that we would generate 27,000 new jobs, enough in principle to put 1 in 7 residents of that region back to work. It would pay about $1 billion. The additional taxes that state and local government would collect would be about $126 million. And by putting people back to work, we wouldn't have to pay unemployment benefits, so that would save another $127 million. So this would be a bonanza to the public sector. And this is the kind of measures that we need in order to target what our priorities should be for local business creation. Now, it turned out in Cleveland that we needed additional capital, about $735 million, to affect the 25% shift. Now, $735 million, almost $1 billion, that sounds like a lot of money, but you don't require a 25% shift of investment to get there. In fact, if you shifted just 1% of what people had in their savings accounts, you could get the 25% shift in food. Or if you shifted 1/4 of 1% of what people had in their pension funds, you could create this 25% food shift. What about policymaking? There's a long list of ideas, and I am really delighted that Vancouver has taken a lead in promoting local purchasing, the 10% shift across departments. And I'm also pleased to hear that the mayor and others want to take that further. I think one of the ways that we do take that further is we prove that local businesses actually are contributing more to the economy. This isn't a gift. This isn't a special preference for local. It is a rational economic decision because local businesses produce more taxes. Another study that our buddies from Civic Economics did for Arizona, looking at 3 different contract possibilities for office supplies. One was a local company called Wist that spent about 35% of all of the money it received locally. Another was Office Max, a chain, but they still had a supply facility in Arizona, so they spent about 12% of the money in the state. And then there was Staples that had really no presence in the state except for some retail outlets. Now, normally this evidence is inadmissible when it comes to procurement decisions. That's nuts. Because with Wist compared to Staples, you're getting 5-6 times as much in tax revenue. Now think of it this way. 25 years ago, when a knucklehead procurement officer looked at light bulbs, that procurement officer argued, gee, this compact fluorescent costs 20 times more than this incandescent bulb. Therefore, I will never buy that compact fluorescent. And I'm not allowed to look at things like, how long is this bulb going to last? And the fact that this compact fluorescent might last 20 years and the incandescent would last 20 minutes. Now we're allowed to do that. Why not also look at the tax implications of local spending? And we should understand that when a municipality receives a bid from a business for a contract, that is a nominal bid. What the city must do is then analyze how much in additional tax revenue is it going to receive as a result of that bid. And that then leads to the real bid value. And if we alter procurement decisions in this way, which I believe is completely compliant with trade agreements, we will see a huge expansion in local procurement. Purchasing. This is what most of us think about with the 10% shift, shifting your shopping, consumer shopping, business shopping, as well as procurement officers. And the key here, of course, is we want to educate people about the virtues of shopping locally, what are the great deals locally, what are the products that are local, what are the stores that are local. This takes a lot of work. But one of the things that I note about all this stuff is that it costs money. And I've been intensely interested in putting us on a slightly different footing. Because I hate doing any work, whether it is traditional economic development or local economic development, that at the end of the day requires a constant infusion of foundation or public funding. What I'm more interested in is how can we create self-financing economic development programs. So let me give you an example of two programs that are self-financing. In Portland, there is a loyalty card called Supportland. Every time you use that card at a local business, you rack up discount points to be used at other local businesses. There are 200 businesses now that are participating in this. They are paying $50 a month for the privilege of participating in it because it's bringing all kinds of new customers through the door. And there are tens of thousands of people in Portland who carry this card. Another example is Bernal Bucks. It's a debit card from a credit union in a neighborhood in San Francisco, Bernal Heights. Normally, a debit card pays a certain fee amount back to the issuing bank or credit union. But in this case, the credit union said, you know what? We're going to give that money to the local first organization. And you guys go out there and encourage people to use this card to support local businesses. And we will give you our fees to support local first. It's a brilliant scheme. And these schemes are, in fact, self-financing. Another example, and the remaining examples I'm going to give you are of self-financing kinds of programs. Partnerships. How do we get local businesses to work together and be more competitive? Well, Tucson Originals is a group of local food businesses that for 10 years have been collectively buying foodstuffs, kitchen equipment, dishes, and by working together, they bring down the price of doing business. PERS. There's a lot I'm going to say about this shortly, but how do we get more money into local businesses? As was mentioned in the introduction, I've been working of late with a company in New York called Mission Markets, and one of the products that we're developing is called a community portal, where we create a simple internet platform so that a community can steadily bring together local investors and local businesses, and by charging the right kinds of fees in the right places, this kind of mechanism is self-financing, supports the local portal operator, and allows you to kind of grow your local investment universe. People. If we make it easier for businesses to get local investment, why not build local investment into, say, kitchen incubators that are developing local food businesses? I mean, one of the problems is with most business incubators is they are simply real estate gifts that somebody, the government, a foundation, is giving to businesses each year. The smarter way of doing it is to help those businesses develop local stock. And then, upon graduation from the incubator, those businesses surrender, say, 5 or 10% of the stock to the incubator, and then the incubator then sells that stock back out to the public locally, and that's where they get the money for the next round of incubation. What is the biggest challenge on this list? Well, I've concluded, you know, and I do these kinds of talks 50 times a year in every imaginable place, large and small, and the verdict that comes back pretty universally is the biggest challenge is in purse. It is how we get capital into businesses. And here's the reason we have this problem. It's you. And I'm going to show you why. By show of hands here, how many people here have done some kind of act of local purchasing over the past week? Of course, you wouldn't be here. How many people here do their banking at a local bank or credit union like Van City? All right. I see a few hands didn't go up. We're going to beat you up afterwards. How many of you have your pension funds in locally owned business? I see a hand that maybe it's itching a little bit. All right. This is outrageous. You folks are the most locavorish representatives of British Columbia, the most local-minded province in Canada. And you folks are systematically overinvesting in global companies and ignoring local companies we've just proven are essential for community well-being. Now, the least we can say about this is a market failure. And the degree of failure can be measured in billions of dollars. The reason we have this failure is that your country and mine created a welfare program for lawyers called securities law back in the 1920s. And that system of securities law really created a system of investment apartheid. If you are in the upper 1% of income or wealth, like my friend here, you can invest in anything, any business, any time, no questions asked. If you're in the other 99%, then we're going to require that company to put together thick disclosure statements. Now, on the surface, this makes sense. We want to protect people from buying swamp land in Florida. But these disclosure statements often run in the hundreds of pages. They are written in 9-point font. They are often in all caps type. No human being has ever actually been observed to read these documents. They cost $50,000 to $100,000 of a lawyer's time. And yet, if you want to put $1 in a local business, that business has to spend $100,000 on lawyers. Something is fundamentally wrong with this picture. Now, if I look at financial assets in Canada right now, actually the most recent data I got were in 2005, looking at the money you have in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, insurance funds, it's a little over $2 trillion. $2 trillion. Now, about two-thirds of your economy is local small business. It's higher than in the United States. So if we got this market to operate efficiently, it would mean a transfer of more than $1 trillion from Fortune 500 global companies into local business. And I suggest that kind of investment capital might make a little bit of a difference in our communities. So how can we tap the 99% of investors who are unaccredited to put money into the two-thirds of your economy that is small and local business? I want to quickly share 10 techniques some of which we're seeing in Canada as well as the United States, some of which I hope will soon come to Canada. Number one, specialty certificates of deposit. In the United States, we have a couple of examples of banks or credit unions that have created special kinds of certificates of deposit, the proceeds of which are used exclusively to support certain local businesses. An example, Equal Exchange, a fair trade company in Boston, approached their local bank, once called Wainwright, now called Eastern, and they got them to create a fair trade CD. Bank thought, great idea. We're going to be the only bank in the country that promotes fair trade CDs. They got $1 million of these CDs sold to their customers, most of whom are unaccredited investors. And as a result, Equal Exchange now has $1 million line of credit. And I understand that Vancity has a resilience fund which operates in some ways similarly to this concept. So this is beginning to percolate in Canada as well. Number two, co-ops. In the United States and in Canada, co-op memberships are not treated as securities, but sometimes pieces of co-op financial activity, like when they give loans, that may be regarded as a security. But generally speaking, it's a lot easier and cheaper for people who are members of co-ops to invest in them. And so one way Americans have been investing for years in local business is through their co-ops. Weaver Street Market in Carrboro, North Carolina, needed a third grocery store. They needed to borrow $1 million, and they did so from their members, agreeing to pay them back between 5 and 8% per year for the privilege of using their money. Number three, Lion. Lion stands for the Local Investment Opportunities Network, started by this guy on the right, James Fraser, in Port Townsend, Washington. Port Townsend is a town of about 10,000 people just north of Seattle. James Fraser used to be a successful hedge fund operator in New York, felt guilty about all the bucks he got, came back to Port Townsend and said, I want to do something more positive in my community. Now, there's one feature of securities laws in the United States and Canada that we haven't talked about, and that is, short of going fully public, if you're just doing a private offering, which could cost still a lot of money, you still can't approach strangers with your private offering. You can only approach people that you know, people you have a pre-existing relationship with. So what Fraser came up with was brilliant. He throws a party every month, brings in businesses and investors, plies them with good food and alcohol, and at the end of the party, he distributes a list. And you have to check off with whom you now have a pre-existing relationship. And then, based on that Yenta work he's doing, he distributes business plans that he receives to those with pre-existing relationships. Just this one social invention in a 10,000-person town has led to $1 million more of local investment per year since 2008. Number four, sponsorship sites, Kickstarter, Indiegogo. This Kickstarter offering here is the Brickside Brewery in Michigan, Copper Harbor's first microbrewery. If you give them $1, you will get a thank you note. If you give them $25, maybe you'll get a t-shirt. If you give them $1,000, maybe you'll get the beer named after you. From the standpoint of our securities regulators, the thank you note, the t-shirt, the beer name, these are not valuable returns on your investment. So this is a total dodge of securities laws. Now you're thinking, who would in their right mind give money to a business for a t-shirt? And the answer is, last year, somewhere around $150 million worth of business just on Kickstarter. and they're ahead of those numbers this year. There's also a growth of sites doing internet lending. Kiva is a microlender. It's basically a virtual Muhammad Yunus, virtual Grameen Bank. Put $100 into a micro entrepreneur in Bolivia. Now, you don't get interest from this. You just get your principal back. By not paying interest in the United States, this is not regarded as a security. So again, another artful dodge of securities law. Now, we do have sites like Prosper and the Lending Club that do pay interest. And they have had to do millions of dollars of securities work to allow unaccredited or slightly accredited investors to participate. Now, I should say my hesitation about fully, you know, before I fully embrace Kickstarter, Prosper, or Kiva, is to say every $100 you put in a micro entrepreneur in Bolivia is $100 you're not putting into a micro entrepreneur in Vancouver. And I think what we need to do is start being very mindful to insist that these sites or their progeny focus on bringing together local investors and local businesses, as Mission Markets Community Portals do. The Funding Circle in the UK does this, and they have community circles that bring together local investors and local borrowers. Number six, pre-selling. Awaken Cafe is a great coffee house in Oakland. They lost their lease. They needed to move to another place. They needed $100,000 to move. The last thing they wanted to do was to waste $100,000 on attorneys. So they decided they would just pre-sell coffee. The deal was, give us $1,000 today, and this will entitle you when we open the new store to $1,200 of coffee tomorrow. This is how they financed their move. Now, it turns out in a majority of U.S. states, this is not a security. And this is another great dodge around securities laws. Number seven, now we get into some interesting stuff. Local stock. In the United States, as in Canada, it is possible to create stock that is only issued, purchased, and traded within a state or a province. Local stock. But it's expensive. An example is community grocers in Mount Air, Iowa. This picture comes from downtown Mount Air. I think it may be downtown extends maybe one more storefront in either direction. Community grocers created a small stock issue. They sold it to 300 people living in Mount Air. Mount Air probably doesn't have more than 2,000 people living there. People bought up the stock. And what happens when you're a shareholder of community grocers? You're kind of loyal to the company because you're connected to the well-being of that company. And so despite the presence of things like Walmart's, community grocers has tripled in size over 15 years, and they pay an average dividend of 5%+ per year. So it's been very lucrative for the holders of this stock. Now, there's lots of examples of local stock, but what really burns me about these examples is that they came about either because someone paid lawyers $50,000 to $100,000, or someone got a lawyer to contribute his or her time for free, which, knowing lawyers, is a miracle. Now, I understand that securities laws are all about protecting people, protecting the unwashed, the unknowing, from making undue risks in businesses and being taken to the cleaners. But it seems to me that we have a contradiction in our societies, equally true in the United States as in Canada. A Canadian or an American can go to any one of 1,000 casinos And when they walk through the door of that casino, does someone stop them and say, "Excuse me, but are you an accredited gambler?" No, that never happens. Before they sit down and play blackjack, do they say, "Will you please read this thick disclosure statement on blackjack, all the risks, and sign before you start playing?" No, you don't have to do that. So we have two systems of risk management in this country and yours. One system of risk management says we allow everyone to gamble irrespective of their income. They can lose everything. We don't care. Go ahead, have a party. And then we have another system called investing in local small business in order to protect our communities, where we say, sorry, unless you bribe a lawyer $100,000, you can't play. Something was deeply unjust about that system. So based on that observation, I wrote a piece in a journal issued by the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is in charge of our currency, among other things. And the journal article basically said, a little bit mischievously, we should create a $100 exemption to securities laws. $100. No questions asked, you can put $100 in anything. No paperwork whatsoever. $100 was no more risky than a Chinese dinner for two at a new restaurant. Now, we don't require that Chinese restaurant to go through $100,000 of disclosure work before they open their doors. So, to me, the logic seemed perfect. I had friends in Oakland who wrote a rulemaking petition to the Securities and Exchange Commission around this $100 exemption. Hundreds of letters came in to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then, what happened? Nothing. Securities and Exchange Commission just yawned. Well, about 18 months ago, on Capitol Hill, the Tea Party-led Government Operations Committee in the House had Mary Shapiro, head of the SEC, before them, and asked her, "Ms. Shapiro, whatever became of this $100 exemption proposal that you've had sitting on your desk for 3 years?" And she kind of twisted around uncomfortably in her seat and said, "Well, we get these kinds of reform proposals all the time, and maybe in a few months we'll convene a committee to look at this and see whether we'll do anything." The committee went ballistic. The United States is at 9% unemployment. This is a no-brainer approach to put capital into the only businesses we know can create jobs. And yet you're going to kind of, sort of, create a committee around this in 3 months after it's been sitting on your desk for 3 years? What happened next was extraordinary, because that committee unanimously, Tea Party Republicans, Occupy Wall Street Democrats, passed not a $100 exemption, but a $10,000 exemption. Now, I wasn't sure what I thought about a $10,000 exemption. This moved to the Senate. It was deliberated on for several months, and then this guy said, "Get it done," and it was voted in by a vote of about 75 to 25, or a supermajority. The law is now that any American can put as much as $2,000 per company per year at a very reasonable cost. In other words, in 1 year, we have made local investment legal. Now, I think this can happen in Canada and should happen in Canada. And if it can't happen nationally, it should happen provincially. Because, you know, we know from healthcare that one province can shake up the system, Saskatchewan. Why not have British Columbia shake up the system when it comes to local investment? Once we have a lot of local stock being issued, the next stage is going to be to create local stock markets, virtual places where people can buy and sell their securities. And that's really what the Mission Markets community portals are all about. It's creating liquidity in local securities. Now, no one should take as a message from what I'm saying tonight that you should pull all of your money, all of your savings, and throw it in your one favorite local business. You know, we got to apply investment sensibility. We have to diversify our portfolio. The problem in the United States is that the laws around investment pools is even worse than the laws around the issuing of stock. So that's a whole nother thing that we have to begin to work on. Like, you're maybe thinking, well, we can have local mutual funds. True enough, in the United States, actually, we could have local mutual funds. But in fact, we have 7,500 mutual funds in the United States, and not a single one invests in local small business. Not by law, just because of an absence of creativity. I don't believe there are any mutual funds in Canada that invest in local small business either. So you have the same problem. So instead, what we're stuck with are a couple of little exemptions in the Investment Company Act that allow us to, say, create nonprofit revolving loan funds for small business. So, for example, this guy, Steve Fireman in Columbus, Ohio, runs something called the Economic and Community Development Institute. He has 14 revolving loan funds for small business, and the most recent fund that he created allows unaccredited investors to participate. This, however, is our secret weapon, the RRSP, done in a self-directed way. Because in Canada, as in the United States, you are allowed to roll over money to a guardian, a self-directed guardian, and tell that person, you don't want your money to go into this Fortune 500 fund anymore. You want that money to go into everything we just talked about. Put your money in targeted CDs. Put your money in co-ops. Put your money in an investment club, in local stocks, in Steve Fireman's fund. The law in the United States, and my understanding is that it's fairly similar in Canada, is that you can use your self-directed IRA to invest in just about everything except your own house or your kid's house. But interestingly, you can invest in your neighbor's house, and your neighbor can invest in your house. And therein lies my talk for next year. I think that if you're looking for, like, low-hanging fruit, and I said this to your mayor before we got started tonight, for a couple of $1,000s of city money, Vancouver could create just a list of every plausible local investment in the municipal area. Just a list. They're not doing any transactions. They're just letting people know, here are folks who have local investment opportunities. And then do a deal with a couple of accountants or a couple of banks or a couple of credit unions to do self-directed RRSPs en masse at a very low fee. I believe instantly you would see millions of dollars of transactions occur from just those two simple acts that would cost several thousand dollars of a website designer's time. It's a no-brainer. Now, what about the returns on local investment? Surely you're thinking, if you throw all your money away in those pitiful local businesses, you will never get the vast wealth that you're receiving putting your money in Toronto or Wall Street. And, you know, if you have a kind of pathetic social life like I have, you get done off the road on Saturday, you know, clean your clothes, you're listening to bad AM radio, and there are these investment advisors with their shows on Saturday saying, keep your money in Wall Street, 10 years, no 20, no 30 years, and you will get 7%, no 10% per year, no 15% per year. All of these numbers are made up. There is, talk about fraud. Everything that the industry has told us about the rates of return you are getting on your pension funds is fraudulent. As I show in Local Dollars, Local Cents, if you look at the historic rate of return of the Standard & Poor's Index since 1879, take out inflation, add in dividends, and the typical rate of return is not 8% or 10%, it is 2.6%. And what is it in the TSX? Well, the last time I did some measuring, it's 2.2%. 2.2%. So we have been taken for a massive ride. I believe there are plenty of local investments that can beat those paltry numbers. I've shared with you some of them. Equal Exchange, paying their shareholders 5% per year. Community Grocers, dividends of over 5%. Weaver Street Market, 5 to 8%. I'm not saying that every local business is going to beat every global business, but I'm saying what exists is possible. And it does suggest the emergence of an industrial alternative to Wall Street. In the United States, the size of the shift that we are looking at from Wall Street to Main Street, if we get markets to work properly, is not a little over $1 trillion, it's $15 trillion. And I often wonder, what happens when the first $1 trillion moves from Wall Street to Main Street? Well, the prices of Wall Street stocks get lower because there's less demand for them. The prices of local stock go up because there's more demand for them. Mainstream investment advisors start to notice, and they encourage more of their customers to follow the smart money and take it out of Wall Street and put it into Main Street. This $15 trillion shift in U.S. and $1 trillion shift in Canada could proceed really quickly. And this would be the most colossal shift in capitalism in its history on how the systems move. Where I want to end tonight's talk and how I end my book is with a children's tale, A Blue So Blue, written by Jean-Francois Dumont. And it's a story of how we often overlook the obvious in our own backyards. In this book, there is a boy who is obsessed with painting the color blue. Everywhere he goes, he paints blue. But there's one shade of blue that haunts him in his dreams. And he can't figure out, where does this blue come from? So he sets out on an international journey to find this color of blue. He goes to the Louvre, check out the paintings of the masters. Is the blue there? No, doesn't find it. He goes on an ocean journey to find patches of water where he might find that blue. He still cannot find it. He goes to a blues bar in New Orleans. Nope, can't find it there. He then goes to a desert, and there a blue-hooded stranger says, "What you've been looking for may never have been very far away." And suddenly it dawns on the boy. The blue that had mesmerized him in his dreams, the blue he was looking for all across the planet, actually was right in his own backyard. It was in his mother's eyes. And that, my friends, is the secret of local investing, the secret to shifting our community toward real prosperity. Thank you very much.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.